You're listening to a message from Every Nation GTA. For more information, please visit our website at everynationgta.org.
My name is Richard, and it's really great to have you here. If you're here for the first time, it's really an honor and a privilege to have a first-time guest with us. We hope it doesn't stay as a first-time guest, so make sure you stick around after the service. We've got refreshments happening in the foyer. We'd love to get to know you a little bit better. And you're joining us in part six of a series we've been doing. We finish next week. In fact, Pastor Bert will be closing us out next week. And so we're going to jump in, and it's called Empires and Exiles. And we've been working through a book in the Bible. It's called the Book of Daniel. It's written by Daniel, who was a young man, and he was part of a period in the nation of Israel's history where they were taken over by this Babylonian Empire. And history books will tell us Babylonian Empire was one of the most powerful empires. And they overtook Jerusalem and took a bunch of the nation of Israel into captivity and took them to the city, the biggest city in the known world at that time, called Babylon. And Daniel's all really about how do the people of God stay faithful to Yahweh in a culture and in a city and in an environment that's very different to where they've come from. Jerusalem is God-centered. They go to the temple. They can worship God freely. They're now in Babylon, which is pluralistic. They're one of many religions, one of many gods. And so they're figuring that out. And so we've been journeying with Daniel. He's now an old man as we enter this story. And if you grew up in any part of church, this might be a very familiar story to you. It's all about how Daniel lands up in a den of lions. Daniel and the lion's den. And so we're going to jump in Daniel chapter 6. And so for the sake of time, I'm not going to read the entire chapter, which is kind of what I've been doing the last few weeks. I'm just going to jump about just to make up some time, and I'll fill in the blanks for you. But the Babylonian Empire has now ceased. It's been overthrown by another empire, the Medo-Persian Empire. And this is the early years of the reign of the Medo-Persian Empire under King Cyrus and Darius, as we're going to see here today. And so we're going to read verses 1 to 3, and then we're going to jump to 10 to 11, and then 19 to 28, and then we're going to look it away. And so really what this chapter does, what I'm trying to do here is what this chapter does, it really gives a summary of Daniel's 70 plus years in Babylon. And it's very helpful for us, very applicable. You might be asking, what on earth does a story that took place 25 plus 100 years ago in a culture very different to ours, what on earth does it have any relevance to us in modern Toronto in the 21st century? It has absolutely immense application to us because it gives us some ideas and a model and a way of working out and living out faithful to God or following Jesus, or what following Jesus would even look like in a modern city like ours, surrounded by a variety of beliefs and values. And so let's join him in Daniel chapter 6, verse 1. It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps, that's just officials, to be throughout the whole kingdom, and over them three presidents, of whom Daniel was one, to whom these satraps should give accounts, so that the king might suffer no loss. Then this Daniel became distinguished above all the other presidents and satraps because an excellent spirit was in him. And the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. So Daniel's risen to a level of immense leadership and influence in what is a very pagan, a very idolatrous and somewhat evil kingdom or empire. He's not just hiding out in a corner. He is up there with one of the king's almost three most influential people in his kingdom. And so what happens is Daniel's distinguished because he does his job really well. We're going to touch on that a little bit later. They notice that he's excellent and he always seems to get the promotion. Do you know someone like at work? They just always seem to get the break, the promotion. Daniel has a little help from his God. You know, he's been able to interpret dreams, and that's also lent him the king's ear from time to time. But by and large, Daniel's really good at what he does. And so jealousy comes about among some of these other officials. They get jealous of Daniel. And they try to look for a way to discredit him. And they can't. The Bible actually says they looked and they couldn't find any fault in him. And so they decide to trick the king and said, "The king, I think for 30 days it would be a good idea for everyone in your kingdom, instead of praying to their gods or going to this person, they should only consult you, only go through you." It was more a political thing than a religious thing. It wasn't like the king was setting himself up to be a god, but it was kind of weird as well in that sense. But the king agreed, and they said, all the officials, all the presidents were all in agreement, which was a lie, because Daniel wasn't consulting this, he wouldn't have been in agreement. But anyway, they lie, and the king signs a decree for 30 days. If you're going to pray, you're going to consult anyone, it's got to go through the king. And the penalty is, if you didn't do that, it would be death. You'd be taken out. It would be seen as treason. It'd be disobeying the king. And so the king thinks it's a good idea, and he signs this document. And so verse 10 tells us, when Daniel knew that the document had been signed, he went to his house, where he had windows in his upper chamber open toward Jerusalem. He got down on his knees three times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as he had done previously. Then these men came by agreement and found Daniel making petition and plea before his God. So Daniel, they knew, this is what Daniel does, this is his custom. And so they knew, okay, great, we've got him. So they go, and they expose him, they go to the king. Hey king, remember that decree the other day signed? Well, Daniel disobeyed. And this brings the king, he gets distraught. Why? Because Daniel is one of his most trusted advisors. Like, it's not a happy thought for him to now have to execute his signed document, but at the same time, he's bound by his word, and he's given his word. He doesn't want to also appear potentially weak as a king. And so, they have a punishment by throwing people into a lion's den, which is kind of weird. It's kind of like you've got a place where lions roam, and they get hungry, and every now and again, you throw people to them. So, aren't we glad we're in modern times? So, we're going to pick up in verse 19 and see what happens. So, Daniel's been thrown into this lion's den. The king says, man, I just really hope your God can save you. The king has a restless night, and in the very first thing the next morning, he comes. Then at break of day, the king arose and went in haste to the den of lions. As he came near to the den where Daniel was, he cried out in a tone of anguish. The king declared to Daniel, O Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions? Then Daniel said to the king, O king, live forever. May God, my God, send his angel and shut the lions' mouths, and they have not harmed me, because I was found blameless before him, and also before you, O king, I have done no harm. Let me just pause there. Now, to the modern mind, this might be a little bit like, okay, this is kind of the stuff of children's books. And so, in one sense, we can understand them. Here's what this is. The Bible is full of what we call miracles, supernatural occurrences. And simply, if we believe in God and we trust God, then we believe that God is transcendent, that he can do stuff and enter nature and change things that naturally don't follow logic. Logically, lions are created to hunt. Put a person in their midst, they're not going to come up and snuggle like a little kitty cat, right? They're designed to eat. So what we see here, we see a supernatural occurrence where God is able to shut these lions' mouths. An angel joins Daniel for the night. And ironically, Daniel seems to have a more peaceful night than the king sleeping in his palace. That says something for being in the center of God's will. So let's continue. Verse 23, then the king was exceedingly glad. Yes, my best worker is alive. And commanded that Daniel be taken up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no kind of harm was found on him. Amazing. Because he had trusted in his God. And the king commanded, and those men who had maliciously accused Daniel were brought and cast into the den of lions, which was the way in the ancient and Near East. Kind of like an eye for an eye, tooth for tooth. If you maliciously accused whatever punishment you sought to bring upon a person, that would then return to you. What was incredibly malicious was what the Medo-Persians added is this, not just you, but your family, they, their children, and their wives. And before they reached the bottom of the den, the lions overpowered them and broke all their bones in pieces. So the author's putting that there and said, these are normal lions. They weren't tamed lions. They weren't lions that had just really had a real fat meal. And so for some reason, they were just really sluggish and couldn't be bothered when Daniel entered the den. There wasn't the same fate that the accusers and his families. So let's continue on in pieces. Verse 20, where are we? 20. There we go. Just go to the next slide. Are we done? Okay. Are we done with that? I think. There we go. Okay, great. Here we go. Verse 25. This is the good part. Then the king Darius, however you want to pronounce it, my British roots say Darius. North America seems to want to say Darius when I've listened to it. So whatever you choose, whatever you want to call him. Then King Mark wrote to all the peoples, nations, and languages that dwelt in all the earth. Peace be multiplied to you. I make a decree that in all my royal dominion, people are to tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. Amazing. For he is the living God, enduring forever. His kingdom shall never be destroyed, and his dominion shall be to the end. He delivers and rescues. He works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth. He who has saved Daniel from the power of the lions. So this Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. And so this is an amazing story, but it's also a really reflective of Daniel's life. And so what I wanted to do is I want to focus on three things that we see in this story, but also three things as we've been tracking throughout this series that are incredibly noteworthy of Daniel's life, and particularly how Daniel models living faithfully in what we call exile, in a foreign place, a place that wasn't conducive to the worship and faithfulness to his God, that constantly the culture was pressuring him to abandon that or compromise that. And in some ways, in modern living today, if you're a follower of Jesus, there can be those similar kinds of pressures. And so what I want to look at today is what three key elements of faithful living over a lifetime look like. And so number one, character. We're going to look at culture. And then obviously, we're going to look at Jesus Christ. He is the hero of the story. He is the hero of the Bible. So quickly, number one, cultivate your character through faithfulness. So when you read Daniel, in chapter 1, we see Daniel as a teenager. He's probably about 16 or 17 when he gets deported, and he goes off to Babylonian University, and then he goes up the ranks. There's just something special about him. And so chapter 2, chapter 3, chapter 4, chapter 5, chapter 6, we see these amazing, miraculous stories. He's got three friends with him. We've seen these three friends go into a furnace and come out miraculous. We've seen him interpret dreams. And so in many ways, Daniel chapter 1 through 6 was Daniel's Instagram account. It's like the highlight reel, like, hey, here's me with three of my friends. Can you see them in the fire there? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Boom, there we go. It's him with King Nebuchadnezzar. This is the king. He's not doing so well. He's kind of chewing on some grass at the moment. Cha-ching. So we get these highlight reels, and in some ways, it's amazing. We just think, wow, Daniel lived a real supernatural, exciting, amazingly awesome life. The reality is, this is over a 70-year-plus period, and we forget that. One of the challenges in our day and age is we look for the highlights reel. We're a celebrity-driven culture. We're a fame-seeking culture. We're an instant gratification culture. And so it's hard to sometimes think that faithfulness and cultivating character really comes through the ordinary, sometimes mundane, everyday stuff of life. What is that for you? For many of you, it's your studies. For many of us, it's work, family, relationships, paying bills, being kind to your neighbors or just greeting your neighbors. It's just boring stuff that's just not going to make the front page news, unless it's attached with some kind of scandal. But this is what God's encouraging, not just Daniel, not just the nation of Israel, but his people throughout the ages. Be faithful with where you're at and what you're doing. Don't run the risk of being tempted to seek after the extraordinary. That may come. God may give you a position of influence like Daniel. But for most of us, we're not going to be in the front ground, foreground. We might play a role in the background. But our character is cultivated, firstly, in the everyday things of life. There's another prophet, Jeremiah, who wrote to these exiles in this time period, encouraging them of what it looks like to be faithful to God. Listen to what he says, and look how ordinary the things God commands them to do. Thus says God, to all the exiles whom I have sent, not the Babylonians have captured you. This is part of my providence and plan, which has been a theme throughout Daniel. Doesn't matter what appearances look like. The Babylonians do look big and dangerous and powerful, but they have the power they have because one more powerful is above them, and he's somehow weaving this into his greater plan. Anyways, I have sent into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. Build houses, live in them, plant gardens, eat their produce. In other words, settle down, get a job, do it well, and enjoy the fruitfulness from your labor. What? God, we're in Babylon. This is like not the place we want to be. We want to be in Jerusalem. Surely you want us to return to Jerusalem. You want us to overthrow the, you're going to deliver us from the Babylonian Empire. And God says, I am, but it's going to take about 70 years. So settle down. In fact, most of you are going to die in Babylon, and your children will see in exile, and they'll continue to build. Not quite the prophetic word that you want, right? Hey, God, get me out of this company. Ah, no, stick there, stay. This boss is really bad. Yeah, I know. Bless him, pray for him. Seek his promotion.
Oh.
Okay. Take wives, have sons and daughters. Take wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage, that they may bear sons and daughters, multiply there, and do not decrease. There's something tremendously spiritual about seeing God in the mundane, ordinary, boring stuff of life, like parenting, marriage, working a job, cultivating. But in that is something very profound, and it builds our character. The second thing is we need to cultivate character in spiritual vitality. When the pressure came, Daniel simply did what he had always done. You know, pressure doesn't build character as much as it reveals what's there. When you're in the crisis, that's not the time to build the character. Daniel's not jumping and falling down on his face because he now is threatened with life. That was his normal, habitual practice for year upon year upon year, and now he's simply doing what he's always done, and he's going to God. And again, that's the mundane, boring stuff of just the regular disciplines of life. You know, we want to live for the moments. We want to live for the moment of chapter 1 to chapter 2 of these incredible moments. And gosh, do we need moments? Do we need moments where we see the supernatural, miraculous intervention of God into our lives? We do need those. But far more than moments is we need to build momentum between those moments. Otherwise, if we just live for the moment, we will never mature fully and grow fully as God would want us to. And there's plenty of people around that. They just jump from the next exciting thing to the next exciting thing to the next exciting thing and never really get stuck in to the momentum building between those moments. So what does cultivating spiritual vitality look like? Well, it looks a lot like, in Daniel's place, discipline and desire. Discipline, it was a set time and a set place. He went every day, three times a day. He sat in his room. He opened the window, faced Jerusalem, and he prayed. They knew that. They knew exactly where he would be. Why? Because he did that. That was his practice. So here's a very practical thing for you. What does it look like in your life? Is there a set time, a set place, a set intentionality that you're building into a relationship with God? Or is it just kind of organic? Just like when the feeling takes over, then I connect with the Lord. And so, hey, do that, man. Connect with the Lord and the feeling's there. But when the feeling's not there, just kick in. You know this in human relationships. You know the minute you begin to decrease pursuing a friendship or a person, or the minute you decrease putting effort into that, into a marriage, those are the first signs of things cooling down and disconnect and disharmony happening in a relationship. And it's no different when we're talking about building a relationship with God, that we need to invest in that. Not only is he doing it, discipline, but he seems to have delight in it. It says he's giving thanks. He knows what's about to happen. He knows that he's about to probably die. He's an old man. He's walked with the Lord. He's probably pretty excited for that fact, maybe. I don't know. But he's seen enough of God's promises that whatever happens to me, my hand is, I'm never at the mercy of you kings. I'm at the mercy of God. And so I thank God. I'm going to bow down and pray to him. And so we see an incredible example there. You know, I'm progressing to my mature 30s. I'm turning 40 next year, okay? Let me just be honest. You want honesty up here, right? I'm excited for it, by the way. 40 is the new 30, apparently, and the 30 is the new 20. So I'm basically turning 20 again next year. But I have noticed in my 30s that metabolism slow down somewhat. In my 20s, my teens and 20s, I could eat whatever I want. I was pretty active. I played a lot of sport. I love sport. And I honestly never, ever even considered diet. I could just, my metabolism was such that. It apparently doesn't go throughout your life. So no one told me that. So I'm having to undo decades of really poor eating habits. But here's what everyone tells me. You can't out-exercise a bad diet. Right? You can't, because losing weight is 80+% what diets, 20+% exercise. It has a factor, exercise, but the predominant factor is what you're putting into your body. You can't out-exercise a bad diet spiritually. The mundane, everyday things that you're building and feeding into your life, you can't out-exercise that by some momentous, miraculous, exciting moments in your walk with the Lord. If you're filling your life with junk, if all you're getting is the little Bible verse of the day, listen, I don't want to knock that, but if that's all you're feeding on, gosh, you're malnourished. I'm talking to Christians here right now. So if all you're doing is that and you've never progressed to a fuller meal, you're malnourished. Because guaranteed in your day, you're being fed social media. You're being fed so many other things, whatever you're looking at or consulting. If you're sitting in a university, you're being fed worldviews. You're being fed philosophies. And so you can't out-exercise a bad diet. We need to change and trust our diet as we feed on God. The second thing is we want to connect with culture. I think this is incredibly important for us as individuals, but us collectively as well. We need to connect with culture. Sociologists tell us that any minority group in a society has one of two responses to avoid the pain of clashing and conflicting with the dominant culture in society. They either compromise or they tribalize. Compromise is when they assimilate into the culture. They don't want to stand out, so they take on the practices of the culture. They're not necessarily a bad thing, by the way. So coming to Canada, for instance, they start drinking Tim Hortons. They learn what a puck is, right? They assimilate. The extreme of that is they lose all the distinctions of who they are, where they've come from. The opposite is the culture at large is scary. Perhaps it's even seen as negative, corrupting even. And so they retreat within their group to hold on to what makes them distinct. Their language, their practices, that kind of thing. Again, not necessarily a bad thing. Be proud of your thing. But if you do that to the point where it cuts you off from society, it's a bad thing. So they tribalize. They stay within their group. There's safety within the group. And a wall is built between them and the rest of society. Sociologists tell us. You can see this in kindergarten. You can see this in school. What do you tell your children when they go to school? You want them to fit in? Compromise? But don't lose yourself. Be your own person. Tribalize. And a kid has got to kind of figure that out. And it's hard. The pressure to compromise is big, right? Because they want to be accepted. They want to be part of it. And so to what level do they compromise? And that's where parents are going to navigate. And so sociologists tell us that. You know, the United States has been called a melting pot. The United States is a very compromising culture. They want you to assimilate into American culture because American culture is so great. And people are very happy seemingly to do that. Or at least they were. There's a bit of backlash now to that. But America's always been called a melting pot. Canada, not so. Canada's been called a mosaic. We're a little bit more on the tribalized. Take pride in your distinctions. Take pride in what makes you different. There's space for everyone in this country. To the point where it's kind of hard to really define what is a Canadian, right? What is a Canadian? I mean, how many of you are Canadian citizens, but you weren't born in Canada? Just raise up your hand. Right, that's a lot of people. And so it's an interesting thing to do with culture. So how does it apply? Well, this pattern comes to the church, comes to Christianity. Now, if you're not a Christian here, this is a great moment in the service where you can sit back and watch us just poke a bit of fun at Christians and the weird things that they do. Christians do the same thing. So we can go to the accommodation route, the chameleon reaction. We can want to be so relevant to the culture that we just want to fit in like a chameleon. And we do such a good job that there's no difference between us and the culture. We lose all our distinctions. It might come from a good motive of not wanting to be in conflict with the culture, of wanting to build bridges with the culture. It comes from a good place. But the extreme, or if we're not careful with that, is we actually then have nothing to offer the culture because we're no different to the culture. We water down our values and the things that we think can really benefit in order to bring peace and harmony in the culture. And the culture enjoys that because they see then a Christianity or a faith that's comfortable and acceptable to them, but doesn't bring any of the life change that the gospel really, truly promises. Jesus calls this out when he says, you lose your saltiness. You've lost that which is to bring a sense of change to the culture. The flip side is we can go to the tribalize or withdraw from culture. And instead of a chameleon, we can be like musk oxen. What do they do when they feel threatened by wolves? Is they get together in a circle and they huddle up. There's safety in the pack. They build a wall between us and them. We're different. There's safety in the pack. And so many Christians and churches think this is the way to go. The world is a bad place. The world is evil and it's dark and it's dangerous. And we retreat and we celebrate our differences. We're not like them. And in order to sustain this, we have to make up rules and regulations in the group as well. We don't do this. We don't listen to that music. We don't do these activities. We don't hang out in these places. We don't associate with these kind of people. And so they become like a withdrawal herd of oxen. Jesus calls this out when he says, what you're doing there is you're hiding your light. Is you're taking your light and you're hiding it. And so there must be a better way. There is a better way to avoid both extremes. And it's this, it's compassionate discernment. That we can connect with culture through having compassionate discernment. Jesus did this so, so well in his incarnation. That he blended in, but also remained distinct. There's a way that to blend in with society. To blend into Babylon. To be there, plant gardens, vineyards. But also to maintain our distinctiveness, that we're not going to bow before gods of Babylon, that we serve Yahweh. Jeremiah goes on in that letter that I read to you now, verse 7, he says, but seek the welfare of the city where I've sent you into exile. Pray to the Lord on its behalf, for in its welfare you will find your welfare. That welfare word is the word shalom. And it sometimes just translates as peace, but it's so deep. It doesn't just mean peace, the absence of conflict. God's shalom brings a holistic well-being, prosperity, health, success, peace, salvation. It's Genesis 1 and 2. It's the way he designed the world to have shalom, peace, flourishing, human flourishing. And he calls us to pray for Toronto to have its shalom. Pray for Toronto to flourish. Pray for the governors and leaders, regardless of what God they bow to, pray for Toronto to flourish. Because in its flourishing will be your flourishing. This is radical words that he's written to his people. And it's radical for us because sometimes we think like we need to withdraw the city. We're not quite sure sometimes the city. Or, you know, there's the Bible, there's C.S. Lewis, and then there's Dr. Seuss. In other words, Dr. Seuss says it like this. Unless someone like you cares a whole awful lot, nothing is going to get better. And so, yeah, maybe the world is bad and it's dangerous and it's dark. But is the answer to withdraw from that? To retreat from that? When we believe Jesus entered that to bring about change in that? I think there's a different way. So compassion means to move towards, to look upon with empathy, not judgmental. But then the second part of that is not just to assimilate to the culture, to have distinction. And this word discernment, I think, sums it up well. What is it to discern? Is to have an ability to critically assess something. To have the ability to know what you believe and why you believe. And to know what others believe and why they believe and be interested in that. Discernment is the ability to winsomely answer people when there's a difference of values that you have with their worldview. Not in a judgmental way, but in a confident yet humble way. We're called to be neither chameleons nor musk oxen. We're called to be the people of God, to be the followers of Jesus, to look at how Jesus did this so well. And I love this quote from this rabbi, chief rabbi. He says the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, in one verse commands us to love your neighbor as yourself. But in no fewer than 36 places commands us to love the stranger. This supreme religious challenge for us is to see God's image in one who is not in our image. Yeah, it is. It's a good quote, right? It's meaty. So you kind of like, okay, whoa. God's heart has always been for the nations. Yes, he had pride in a special people, but that special people was always the vehicle to bring about blessing to the nations of the world. And so when Israel's in Babylon, they're looking for what the distinctions between us. You're with me and I'm with me. And God's saying, but look out as well. Just because you don't see the image of you and those other people doesn't mean I don't love them. And that's our big challenge, is to love the stranger, love the person who doesn't agree or value what we value. And so I'll leave that with you. Lastly, if we're going to have longevity in a culture, we need to cultivate our character in that culture. We need to connect with our culture, not withdraw from it, engage it with wisdom and discernment, but be compassionate, care where the city's going, seek its prosperity, its well-being. And when I say seek its prosperity, part of that is bringing about truth and gospel. That's prosperity. It's not just materialism, okay? So hopefully prosperity gospel hasn't robbed us of that word, prosperity. It means more than just material blessing. It's relational health. And how does that come? It comes through the gospel. Jesus, I mean, Bert's offering point, reconciling. That's when we talk about prosperity, it's all of that. But gosh, if we don't somehow count on Jesus in all this, then it's all just in our own strength. You know, the danger of a book like Daniel is Daniel is set up as a prototype. He's set up as a hero. He can do no wrong. Let me just tell you, Daniel was fallen just like you and I are. Remember those highlights reels? There's a lot of lowlight reels that we don't see in Daniel's life. Thank you, Daniel. He doesn't give us that. But the point is, Daniel's a type, what we call a type of Jesus. He points ultimately to Jesus. And so we're to count on Christ if we're going to have longevity and making a difference in society. In verse 23, it says, Daniel was taken up out of the den and no harm was found in him. Why? Because he trusted in his God. Every single person breathing this planet right now trusts in something or someone, particularly to get them out of the dens, the lion dens of life. For some, it's education. That's going to get them out of the den of life that's threatening, the challenge. For others, it's success. It's money. For others, it's comfort. For others, it's raising and having a good family. That's what they're trusting in to get them out of the trials of life, to bring them happiness. Some of those things are not bad things. I have a family. I love my family. But when we make that the source of our trust and identity, we set that thing up to be something it's never designed to be. And this is where Daniel doesn't, he sometimes loving the culture means defying the culture. Daniel is not going to bow to the king. He's going to bow to God. And if that costs him his life, so be it. He's trusted God enough to say, even if it costs my life, I'm going to defy that order. Because God had said, you shall have no other gods before me. And so that's what he's trusting him. Jesus is so beautiful to him. God is so beautiful to him. God is so central to his life. He's trusting him. And when we trust God, when we put Jesus the center of our life, it opens us up to the supernatural, to miraculous, to God delivering us miraculously. Gosh, it would be pretty neat to have some of these things happen to us. But one way or another, when we trust God, God will come through for us. It also provides an anchor to our soul. That we're to have hope, that despite appearances, what Daniel did tell you, despite what looks going on, God is sovereign. He's working at work. When we make Jesus the center of our lives, we begin to feel that, and it takes us through the challenges of life. I want to put up this last image and then close with this verse. Does anyone know this painting? It's apparently disputed, but it's a Leonardo da Vinci, but it's disputed whether he actually painted, but there's good reason to believe that he did. It's his Salvator Mundi. Do you know who that is? That's a very Caucasian-looking Jesus, but it's Jesus nonetheless. This painting was auctioned off this week, and it went for $450 million. So, one, who has $450 million, half a billion dollars to spend on a painting? But the next most important thing about that thing is I find it fascinating that 2,000 plus years on, Jesus still seeks to have the fascination. Okay, this was painted obviously a few centuries ago, but Jesus still seems to capture people's attention. That's a weighty amount of money to put forth for something. Now, whatever you find most valuable in your life, ultimately that's what you look to as your God in your life. Whatever is most valuable to you, that's another way of discerning, is Jesus most valuable to you? Is he the center? Are you counting on him? Does he have the most value to you such that, you know, far exceeds $450 million, such that even if this costs my life, I'm prepared to lay it down, but I'm not going to sell out and put my value in appeasing a king, because there is a king above all kings that I ultimately bow to and I'm accountable to. Jeremiah 29, verse 11 to 13 continues on. I'm going to end with this. God then says this to his people, and this is bumper sticker material. I mean, gosh, this is tattoo worthy. You know, people love this verse, but can you see how this verse is rooted in a much bigger context? That is, God's entering in our dens. He's not necessarily removing us from the dens. You know, Daniel still went into that den. His three friends still entered the fire. They didn't know that they were going to get delivered until they were standing in the midst and like, okay, these lions are not touching me. This is going to be a good night, I guess. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans for welfare, there's that word again. Your prosperity, not for evil. To give you a future and a hope. Then you will call upon me and come and pray to me, and I will hear from you. You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart. Paraphrase, when you count on Christ. Richard's paraphrase, but you know, this is just as good as Jeremiah's. In other words, make me ultimate, seek me, find me, and you will see, you will have future hope. That I'm going to give you welfare, prosperity. I'm going to give you shalom. That's my desire, not just for you, but for your city, for your nation, your family, your neighborhoods. Count on Christ. What does trusting Jesus look like in your life? Is there anything preventing you from trusting him in areas of your life where right now you're perhaps not trusting in him? Let's go to prayer as we consider those questions and invite the band up. Father, we're humbled in this moment, Lord God, that you care for us, not just us individually. You care for cities. You care for nations. Gosh, Lord, you're patient even with officials, nations, people that don't love you, don't acknowledge you. Help us as your people, Lord, in this city that we find ourselves in right now, Lord, to seek the welfare of Toronto. Lord, I thank you that you are and have and will continue to raise up Daniels for this city. People who are sold out to you, but gosh, who are wise to engage the culture and bring about reform in the culture. God, we need more of those. Would even in our midst, Lord, would you call even someone sitting in the university right now have a vision for what that could look like? But above all, Jesus, we can do none of this unless we are leaning on, depending on, having confidence in you and you alone. That you become not just helpful to us, but beautiful to us. Like that painting, that we would spend our life's fortunes to have your beauty, not just hanging up on a wall, but hanging in our hearts. That we walk around with the value of Jesus in our lives. Help us, Lord, if there are areas that we are still not fully yet trusting you, remove those barriers, God. Even as we sang today, God, would you break our hearts? We sang that, Lord. We invited you to come and break that which needs to be broken in our lives in order for us to see your beauty. In Jesus' name we pray.
You've been listening to a message from Every Nation GTA. Thanks for joining us. For more information, visit our website at everynationgta.org.